First of all, I want to tell you, I know nothing about parenting. I have two children. My son is now 41, my daughter is 39. And they are the byproduct of the DNA of myself and my wife. And it was on-the-job training. I learned as I went along with them. And it was always a new day, every day with them. And I learned them because I knew something about me and my wife. So I'm not going to pretend to tell you that I can tell you how to raise your kids. I only learned to raise two, and they were mine. The second thing I'd like to say as a matter of qualification to all this is, when we raised our children, my son was born in 76, my daughter in 78, a lot of the things that parents deal with regard to their children today are not things that we faced with our children. In fact, in the cell phone age, we were even Johnny-come-latelys into that. We were very slow coming into that, primarily because we couldn't afford it. And so we were late coming into that. But now, we don't just have cell phones, we have smartphones, which are many computers in their hands. And the technology that is available to our children, to us today, is not something that was a part of our life, not something we had to filter, not something we had to learn to manage with our children. And so there are some aspects of this that, with regard to where parents are today with their children, that were not part of our lives. Both my children have four children apiece. My son has four boys, ranging from age 17 to age 4. And my daughter has a girl, age 14, and three boys, the youngest of which is 3. It's interesting that my daughter was talking to my wife on the phone the other day and said, "You know, Mom, we face things with me and Cody, face things, that's my son's name, with things with our children that you and Dad didn't face with us." And she was right about that. And she said, "So it's kind of hard for me to call you and ask you, what did you do about this with regard to that, because you didn't deal with that." And there's an element of truth to that. However, my response to my wife was this, and I hope this doesn't sound arrogant. Yes, that's true. But the principles with which we dealt with the problems that they faced are the same principles which, if they will learn, will be the principles they will use with the problems their children face. Those are timeless. Those are not generational. And so I hope this week that we can say some things that you can take and that you can plug into the apparatus with which you and your husband use, or wife, you and your family use to help your children. The next thing I'd like to say with regard to this is, it's easy when you have a series like this to begin to have a lot of duplication. And I will admit there's going to be some duplication. The three lessons today are foundational for the character studies we're going to do during the week. And if I say something today in the course of what we talk about today that you hear later on in the week, understand, I realize I'm repeating myself. I will, however, as we develop the different character studies through the week, try to add elements that I do not include today. But today is foundational for things that we'll talk about the rest of the week. And so I just want to kind of put those things out there for you to understand the premise of things and where I'm coming from. One final thing. I hope that when we're done with this, that what we have learned is not to be better parents. I hope what we have learned when we're done with this is to be better Christians. When I do work on the family at home, and I do a lot of it at home, I don't do it so that I try to make men and women better husbands and wives, or parents better mothers and fathers. My purpose is to try to help each one of us be better as Christians. And if I can help you in a few things to say, hey, as a Christian, I need to think about that in my role as a parent or in my role as a mother or father, a child, then the time we spend will have been benefited. But if at the end, I miss that, I miss having helped you think about being a Christian and how as a Christian you can then implement that into your role as a parent or a child, if I've missed that, then I've missed my target. So I want you to understand, the premise of which I approach this is to try to help us from the Bible, from God's Word, to be better Christians, and then as better Christians in our role as a parent, take those truths and principles and incorporate them into those roles, and therefore make us better in those roles. Becoming a better parent or better husband and wife or better child is a byproduct of growing as a Christian. It's not the objective. It's the byproduct of the objective. And so I want to put that before you as we begin this. The thematic passage that we're going to use for today, at least, in all three lessons, is found in Ephesians chapter 6. And I realize that you probably are well aware of Chapter 6, verses 1 through 4, but I'd like to read that with you as we begin. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and that you may live long in the earth. And you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and training and admonition of the Lord. Every one of us as parents are vitally concerned about the welfare of our children. And I will tell you, when your children grow older and they leave home and they have their own, that doesn't stop. As someone once said, once a parent, always a parent. My dad is 90, my mom's 87, and they're still parents. I still call my dad, it's just a different level we operate at. I still call my dad for advice, he's still parenting me. But we're all concerned, and it doesn't matter that I'm 62, my dad's 90, my dad's still concerned about me. And so we're concerned about our children because we want them not to just be good people. We want our children to be individuals who really have a heart set on pleasing the Lord. Another passage that we'll talk about later on in the lessons, in Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6, you're well aware, train up a child in the way he should go, when he's old he'll not depart from it. I have a little different point of view about that than some people, and I'm not going to be dogmatic about that. I'll just ask you to consider it. But training the child, training, that's what we're talking about. But that involves, number one, someone to train, and number two, someone to be trained. There's both sides of that coin that's there. And so when we talk about this, we're talking about trying to invest ourselves in the lives of our children to give them the greatest advantage as free moral agents, not robots, as free moral agents to learn how to make good choices, and with those good choices, learn how to then be better servants of the Lord. And there are three or four things I want us to look at as we talk about this. The first thing I'd like for you to think about with me I'd like for you to think about this from the standpoint of respect for authority. Now, let me just put one disclaimer here. I'm not a PowerPoint guru, and so I know this is not the correct way you're supposed to do it. So if you're sitting there thinking, boy, he's blown it, this is on purpose. This is the way I do it. I don't keep up with clicks. I'm single I can't multitask. And so I can't click and talk at the same time. So every PowerPoint will have everything up. So you'll see the whole shebang. That's on purpose. I want you to know I am an idiot. I confess to it. I'm an ept. That's enough. Okay. So the first thing we want to talk about is to learn respect for authority. Turn with me to Proverbs chapter 29. Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 15. Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 15. Listen to what Solomon will say here. In the beginning, he says, the rod and rebuke give wisdom, and a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. A child left to himself brings shame to his mother. You know, do any of you ever do any gardening? If you do gardening, what grows in your garden without cultivation? Weeds. A child left to himself is just like weeds. They're going to grow, but they're going to grow up like weeds. And so I think one of the biggest priorities, in fact, I put this number one in the whole list of things, in this whole series of lessons, is to learn a respect for authority. In fact, when you look at the Old Testament, you see how significant that is. Turn to me with Exodus chapter 21. Exodus chapter 21. And when God had the theocratic rule over Israel, I want you to look at what God thought of some things with regard to authority. Exodus chapter 21 and verse 17. He who curses his father's mother shall be surely put to death. Now, it's not so much what they said, curse his father and mother, that's the issue there, though that would have been a byproduct. It's the attitude they had toward their mother and their father. He said, someone that has this attitude of disrespect, so they speak in this manner toward their mother or father, the Lord said, shall surely be put to death. Look with me in Deuteronomy chapter 21. Deuteronomy chapter 21. And look at verse 18. Deuteronomy chapter 21 and verse 18 and forward. He says, in Deuteronomy 21 and 18, if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father, or the voice of his mother, who, when they have chastened him, will not heed them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him, bring him out to the elders of the city, to the gates of the city, and they shall say to the elders of the city, the son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all men of the city shall stone him to death with stones, and so you shall put away the evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear. Now, the first thing I want to say about this passage is, when it talks about the child that's stubborn and rebellious and who will not hear, that's not talking about my 4-year-old and 3-year-old grandsons. That's not talking about them. We had 6 of our grandchildren this last week because we had VBS. And so we've got the 4-year-old and the 3-year-old there, and they're fussing and fighting and competitive all day long. And we're always having, especially Nana, was always having to get on to them. We're not talking about them. We're talking about the 17-year-old, the 15-year-old, and the 14-year-old or older. We're talking about those who have the ability to be rebellious. Those who have the ability to be stubborn. That 4-year-old and 3-year-old are still trying to figure some things out. We're trying to help them figure some things out. But that 17-year-old who looks at his father and in a very rebellious, stubborn disposition says, I will not listen to you. That's the one we're talking about. Now, I don't know if there was ever a child that was brought before the elder of the city. I know what Moses says here. I never find an incident anywhere in the Old Testament that this actually took place. But the point I want to make about this is what God thought about a stubborn and rebellious child. This is what God thought about a child who had a disrespectful attitude toward their parents. I think it is so vitally important that we train our children to respect authority and not excuse their rebellion by just simply saying they have a free spirit. A free spirit is euphemistic for, I have a rebellious child that is stubborn and will not listen. And then what we do is we then find some way to excuse the stubbornness or the rebellion of the child. And a significant feature of that is children learn respect from parents who are respectful and who also respect authority. Rebels are going to have a hard time teaching respect for authority. So if in the home they do not see mother and father respecting authority, respecting the authorities that are civil, respecting authorities that are of a federal level, respecting authorities with regard to the roles of one another in the home, mother and father, the role that a woman has in the home, the role a husband has in a home. If they don't see the respect for those and they hear us talk about respect for authority, then they're going to say, why do I need to listen to you? Because you don't listen to authority. You don't respect authority. And they don't learn it in the home. Question. Where are they going to learn it? My wife teaches first grade. She's entering her 22nd year of teaching in the first grade. And it's interesting that they have this meet the teacher night before school begins. And so these little children come and they meet the teacher. The parents come and the little children come in the classroom and they're just running around helter-skelter, out of control. And of course, my wife is just taking notice of that. That child is marked before the school year ever begins. And the parents always say, that's just the way he or she is. And my wife is thinking in the back of their mind, in the back of her mind, not in my classroom. My wife is very structured in her classroom. In fact, she's the one that the principal gives all the kids nobody else can handle. Because by the time the year's over, she's got them handled. Now, in schools, the teachers can't touch them, period. They can't touch them. But that doesn't mean that they can't get in their face and use plosive syllables like T's and C's and S's and P's, or that she can speak very softly but firm to them. It's always amazing when they walk down the hall that her class always does duck the best. And they're always in line and she never raises her voice. But they're not going to learn that in the schools. That's not where they're going to learn. They're going to learn it because they learn it at home. And when at home we excuse their rebellion, we're setting them up. We're setting them up for having difficulties in life because the time is going to come in which they're going to be out on their own. And they're going to be in college. And they're going to have a professor that only sees them as a number. I know that's not complimentary. I'm sorry about that. They're only going to see that child as a number. They're not going to see that child as a person. And that child is going to come in and he's going to spit at that professor. And the professor is going to say, what number are you? Oh, I see your number. You fail. He's not going to be concerned about passing that child, helping that child. Furthermore, he's going to get a boss. And he's going to appear before that boss and they're going to try to tell that boss how to run his business. And the boss is going to say, excuse me? Who's the employee here and who's the boss here? There's the door for you. And then what the child is going to plead is, I have been victimized. I was in Athens, Alabama 2 weeks ago in a meeting. And there's a family, not where I was preaching, but a family that lives in Athens that used to attend with us years ago when we were College Park. And somebody was telling me about them and some problems they were having in their marriage. And this man was discovered to have been having an affair and had multiple affairs. And the person that was telling me about it said, you know, he's always the one that always is the victim and blaming somebody else for his problems. He hasn't learned the place of authority. And so we're setting them up for difficulties if we don't teach them those roles. Look in Proverbs chapter 30. Proverbs chapter 30. And look at verse 17. Proverbs chapter 30. And I want you to see verse 17. The eye that mocks his father and scorns obedience to his mother, the ravens of the valley will pick it out and the young eagles will eat it. Look furthermore back to Deuteronomy chapter 27. Deuteronomy chapter 27 and look at verse 16. Deuteronomy 27 and verse 16. Again, kind of the same sort of thing emphasized here. Cursed is the one who treats his father and mother with contempt, and all the people shall say amen. I love that expression in Proverbs chapter 30 that we talked about. It talks about the one who looks at the parents a particular way, and they roll their eyes. Here he talks about in 30 and 17 again, the eye that mocks the mother and scorns the obedience to his mother. You know that look. Any parent that has a child knows that look. You know that look. You tell them and they give you that look like you are the dumbest thing that has ever been on the face of this earth. And listen, let's just admit it. Sometimes we are as dumb as we think as they think we are. And we're not the smartest people sometimes because we're learning this. But when they look at us and they roll those eyes and they have that scornful look that is disrespectful, here's what the Lord thought about it. This isn't from the book of Ricky, okay? This is what the Holy Spirit's telling us about this. I want to emphasize that. This is what the Holy Spirit's telling us about this. This is what God had the Holy Spirit have men write down. Ricky didn't invent this. I'm not trying to pontificate to you about this. I'm trying to help us see this is what God thought about when young people were disrespectful. I think there's a second thing that we put right next to that, and that is they need to learn to have authority over themselves. It's not just enough to have respect for authority, but they need to learn to have authority over themselves. Look at Proverbs chapter 16. Proverbs chapter 16, and I want you to see verse 32. Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 32. He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. Here Solomon is telling us that if you have, here's a man that can control his spirit, and he's better than a man that can rule a city. Maybe you've had this problem. Maybe as a child you have it, maybe with children you have it. That you have a child that just has a temper. And I mean, it escalates from just one breath to an explosion in the next. And they've not learned to control themselves. I'm not suggesting that this is something that all of a sudden, when children are born, they have control over. Babies have to be taught this. It's something that is learned. Sometimes an adult will say, you know, I'm sorry, I just have a temper. And I don't want to be cute about that. I don't want to be smart aleck about it. But I say, well, just learn to control it. You made a choice to let your temper be that way. And you can make a choice for your temper not to be that way. It's that simple. If somebody, do you have a chip in your brain that says you can't control your temper? You can't control your anger. You made a choice to allow yourself to be that way because you and I have not learned to control ourselves. But here he says, the person that can control his spirit is better than one that can what? Rule a city. A couple of illustrations in the New Testament. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. When Paul, at the end of chapter 9, talks about how he disciplines himself, I want you to notice how he describes this. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, beginning in verse 24. He says, Do you not know those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore I run thus, not with uncertainty that I fight, not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. What's Paul saying? Paul is saying, I have learned to control myself. The language here is interesting. He says, I have learned to discipline my body. Maybe your translation will say, I have learned to buffet my body. Well, that's really not language we use a lot today either. What he's simply saying is, I have learned to bloody my eye. The word buffet there, the word discipline, is taken from a word or series of words that here is a boxer who has his hand put into a piece of material that will be rawhide-like, that will be wet and formed to his hand. And in that, he will take that and grind that piece of material into sharp objects. And then when it dries, they are set there. And now he's ready to go into the ring to fight. And the purpose of having that hardened fist there with those objects sewn in, molded into that piece there is to strike his opponent in the eye. Why? Because he knows if he can debilitate his opponent, he can win. And the best way to debilitate the opponent is to bloody or to close the eye. Have you seen in boxers or events like that, that when an eye is struck, that thing just puffs up? And they always have a trainer that will come in that will lance it, and then they'll put stuff on it to make it not bleed. And they'll lance it so that it'll go down so he can see. Why? Because if it stays closed, he's got a blind spot, right? He's vulnerable. And what Paul says is, I bloody my eye. I bloody my eye lest I should be disqualified. What Paul is saying here is, as he's talking about this, here is the runner that runs in the race. Here's the boxer that fights. And the runner that runs in the race trains so that the body responds to the mind. And the fighter trains so the body responds to the mind. The body trains so the mind has control over the body. And what he's saying is, I've learned the element of self-control. Marathon runners always amaze me. 26 miles, 385 yards. I just love to watch the marathon races when the Olympics come around, both the male and the female. They just amaze me. The hardest part of the race is not the first part of the race. And it's not the last part of the race. The hardest part of the race is the middle of the race. That's when most of the marathoners drop out. Why? Because their mind has lost the focus of the end, and the body has begun to take over, and the body has said, I hurt, I ache, I'm tired, I'm dehydrated, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this, and the body is telling the mind, quit, quit, quit. But the people that finish the race are the ones whose minds have control over the body. Their body goes through the same thing that the person that quit went through, but their mind is in control over their body. They have learned to control themselves. I would suggest that these two things, respect for authority and learning the control of ourselves, are two of the most challenging things that we as a people, just as people, humanity, face. I mean, just think about it for just a moment. What is one of the greatest challenges of young couples to learn how to manage? Money. We got a point about that later. Money. Number one cause for divorce. 4 to 1. 4 times greater than the next cause. Number one cause for divorce is not sex. It's financial. And today, it is so accessible to have that little plastic card. And all you got to do is scan it or put the chip in. And then it can give you any amount of money that you can have. And you can call and get more if you've overextended yourself. Confession. I don't have a credit card. I cannot handle a credit card. I do not need a credit card. I've learned that the hard way. I'm telling you something, I've learned the hard way. I have debit cards. And debit cards mean if the money's not there, it doesn't work. And what that means is, I've learned the hard way, if I don't have the cash, I don't do it, because there's something about a credit card in myself mentally I don't control. And I've learned how to control myself by simply saying, I can't help. I get a call from these people that said, we'd like to have you give you a credit card. And I tell them, you can't give me a credit card. Oh, yeah, we can. I said, no, you can't. They said, yeah, we can. I said, okay, I'll take the credit card if you promise every time I make a purchase, you pay it off. They said, no, we can't do that. I said, I told you, you can't give me a credit card. We need that. That's one of the biggest challenges. That's one of the greatest illustrations I can give you to learn to control ourselves. In Romans chapter 7, listen to what Paul will say beginning in verse 13. Terry, did I quit at 15 after? Romans chapter 7, verse 13. Has then what is good become death to me? Certainly not. But sin, that it might appear sin, was producing death in me. That what is good, so that sin through the commandment might become exceedingly sinful. For we know the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, soul under sin. But what I am doing, I do not understand. What I will to do, that I do not practice. What I hate, that I do. If then I do that which I will not do, I agree with the law that it is good. But it's no longer I who do it, sin that dwells in me. Verse 20. Now if I do what I will not to do, it's no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. If then a law that is evil is present with me, the one who wills to do good, for I delight in the law of God according to the inward man. Why does he do that which he hates? Why is it that he cannot keep from doing the thing he doesn't want to do? Because he's lost control of himself. Here in this passage, he's given his will over to sin. He's given his will over to the control of Satan. And so in doing so, he has forfeited his free moral agency by allowing himself to be in bondage to the rule of Satan. And so what he's saying is, the reason I sin is because I've lost control of myself. Now think about it. Isn't that true with us? Is there a single sin that we're forced to do? Is there a single sin that if we learn this control over ourselves, we would not be able to conquer? I'm not trying to tell you I do that. I'm trying to address the fact that's why we do this, because we've lost control of ourselves. And one thing we try to teach our children is the value of self-control. When they're in a fight with their siblings and their temper rages, we tell them, get control of your temper. So, as I said, we had six of our grandkids. The two oldest came Friday afternoon. We took them all to the Ranger ball game on Friday night. And they're the two oldest of all the grandchildren, 17 and 15. They're brothers. They've driven 3 hours in the same truck together from Lufkin, Texas to Dallas. They're sitting in the back seat of my pickup. And next thing you know, man, they are going at each other. They like two cats tied by their tail over a clothesline pole. They're just going at one another. And I said, okay, McCoy and Easton, that's the 4-year-old and 3-year-old. I thought, I've been listening to this all week. I got a 17-year-old and a 15-year-old. And pretty soon it escalated to where, and the 17-year-old's got a temper. Sure enough, it blew. And I said, okay, quiet back there. And that was it. Learn control of self. Now, am I talking to parents who haven't had that experience with your children like that? Any of you that have children that are of any age at all? I'm not talking about the 3 or 4-year-old here. I'm talking about when they get in those teenage years and, man, they got that quick button and they're gone. What have we got to do? We're trying to teach them control of self. The next thing I would talk about then is the capacity to believe. Turn with me to Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews chapter 10, and the last part of this passage, Hebrews chapter 10, verse 39 is where I want to be. But we're not of those who draw back to perdition, but to those who believe to the saving of the soul. Notice there are two kinds of people. Those who draw back and those who believe to the saving of believers. What I'm talking about, the capacity to believe, I'm not talking about right things to believe. I'm not talking about in who to believe. I'm talking about the fundamental capacity to believe. To be believers. In fact, more times are God's people in the New Testament identified as believers than they are as Christians. Now, being a believer did not mean there was not something for them to do, but the dude is not what identified them as a believer. We need to teach our children to be believers on Pentecost. The significant thing about those people is when they ask that question, what must I do? Why didn't Peter say believe? Because they were already believers. When he goes to the house of Cornelius, why doesn't he tell Cornelius to believe? Because Cornelius is already a believer. Now here's our challenge, I think. Our challenge is we live in a world that does not encourage that. We live in a world that encourages cynicism. Let me describe two opposites. Here's somebody, it doesn't matter if the sun is shining, not a cloud in the sky. A tornado's coming. It's overcast, it's dark, and the storm is coming. The aquifer's about to dry up, and we're all going to be without water. On the other hand, it doesn't matter if a tornado's coming. It doesn't matter if there's only one drop of water left in the aquifer. There's plenty of water and the sun is shining. Now, why does the first person that way? Because they choose to be that way. Why is the second person that way? Because they choose to be that way. We say we're believers and someone says, well, you're just a believer because you want to be. Right. Right. But why is someone an unbeliever? Because they want to be. We choose to be believers. Have you ever been in the department store, Dillard's, Macy's, or whatever, and you're in the return line, and the person in front of you is talking to the little high school person or college person there that is assigned the job to the return line, and the person is returning this, and you listen to them talk to that high school or college employee there, and they're just absolutely sure that this high school or college student is in on some conspiracy somewhere to have made this article a defective, and now they're bringing it back and they are letting them have it. Why? Because they're just absolutely convinced that there's some conspiracy for why I bought this defective piece of clothing. We're cynical. We're skeptical. Our cynical, skeptical society does not encourage people to be believers. And I hear someone say, yeah, but we don't want children to be gullible. We're not talking about something absent evidence here. But we're talking about in view of all the evidence that's there, there's one choice. Be a believer. Does that mean sometimes you're going to get taken advantage of? Yes. Does that mean sometimes you'll be lied to? Yes. But the option is to be cynical or to be skeptical. That's dark. That's foreboding. Nobody survives long that way. That's why we're encouraged to be believers. Well, where are they going to learn that? Well, they're not going to learn it at work, and they're not going to learn it at school. And they're not going to learn it in society. They're going to learn it in the home. And they're going to learn it in the home from mothers and fathers who are believers. And let me tell you someplace else they can learn it. They can learn it in a local church. They can learn it in a local church where there are people who are believers, who when they see somebody that they know has been taken advantage of and advantage of and advantage of, that person still is a believer. Here's a person that's a doctor. Here's a person that's a police officer. Here's a person that is an engineer. And they're managing people and they know the management of people. That they deal with all the filth that is there. But yet in spite of that, they maintain an optimistic attitude. Why? Because they choose to be believers. Boy, that is so important. Don't breed in... And back up. We must not breed in our children to be cynics and skeptics. We must breed in our children, produce in our children, to be believers. Do you remember the man that brought his son to Jesus because the disciples could not heal him? And he said, Lord, if it's possible, will you heal him? And the Lord said, if you believe, all things are possible. Did you notice how the Lord answered that? He answered in the kind it was asked. Lord, if it's possible, if you can believe, what the Lord asking is, will you be a believer? And the man said, I believe, help thou my unbelief. What the man said is, I choose to trust you, even though I don't understand all this. Because we can't answer every question 100% does not prevent us from being believers. Being a believer does not mean that there's no doubt. Being a believer just says, in view of all the doubt, I still choose to believe. Then, the last thing, as time is about to go out, I think it's important that we teach our children to feel. And I want you to look with me at primarily Romans chapter 12 and verse 15. Romans chapter 12 and verse 15. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. I think it's so important that we teach our children to feel. Turn to Hebrews chapter 13 after I quoted that for time's sake. Turn to Hebrews chapter 13, verse 3. That's where we're going to end. A 5-year-old comes with a little cut on his finger. It really amounts to nothing. And says, I need a Band-Aid. Or will you kiss this? And we as a parent say, oh, that's nothing. Just go, don't cry about that. You go on. Well, maybe we need to teach them that a little bitty cut is really not a big deal. But we need to be careful also we don't rob them of the ability to feel. Listen, daddies. When that 12 and 13-year-old daughter, that 15-year-old daughter comes to you, and her heart has been broken by a lug-headed boy that you want to hug real high and real tight, don't tell her, oh, it's okay, it'll be all right. Because to her, her world just got crushed. We need to teach our children to learn how to feel. How to feel about injustice, how to feel about inequity. When people hurt, but also rejoice with people who rejoice. Years ago, this was over 30 years ago, one of my nephews, his mother had told him, my sister had told him, now Colt, you go put on that shirt. And Colt cried because he didn't like that shirt. And he wanted to keep on his pajama top because it was nice and cotton and it felt good. And his mother said, I'm telling you, you go put that shirt on. If you don't put that shirt on, I'm going to wear you out. Well, being the wise older brother that I am, I looked at my sister and I said, do you have clothes you don't like to wear? I said, if you have clothes you don't like to wear, then why are you making him wear something he doesn't like to wear? Have any of you ever bought clothes that you've worn once and you don't like them anymore? I got some in my closet that way. They don't fit me like I want them to fit. I'm very particular about that. And I thought they looked good. I thought they fit good at the time. But I don't wear them. Why? Because I don't like them. They don't fit. They don't feel good. Now, I'm not trying to be cute with my nephew there. But the point I want to illustrate is this. We need to teach our children and encourage in them the ability to choose to feel. When they hurt, to feel hurt. But when they succeed, to rejoice in their success. Question. Where are they going to learn it? They're going to learn it from a mother and father who, when they succeed, rejoice with them. And when they hurt, hurt with them. You've listened well. Thank you.